time is 9 p.m. You listen to KVMR FM, Nevada City. My name is T.E. Wolf. This is a special edition of A Word in Edgewise, continuing a story from last week in our regular, my regular time slot, which will be continued again next week in the regular time slot. I want to give a big shout out and thanks to Rue and Raven and the Radio Poets for being so very helpful and cooperative and all that good stuff, because we got a lot to get into this hour. As a refresher, or for those who did not hear the show a week ago, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson. In the first installment, we heard the story of the door. We met Mr. Utterson, the lawyer, and his cousin, Mr. Enfield, who told him about an experience he saw, about a hideous little man named Hyde. Utterson knows Hyde to be connected in some way with his friend Dr. Jekyll because of a will Dr. Jekyll had written out, giving everything to Hyde were he to die or disappear. More and more is learned of this Mr. Hyde, and he is quite the hideous character. Jekyll refuses to speak of him. Finally, a year later, there was a murder. A local member of Parliament, an old man, much loved, was beaten to the ground by Hyde, who has since disappeared. And that is where we leave our story. It was late in the afternoon when Mr. Utterson found his way to Dr. Jekyll's door, where he was at once admitted by Poole, the butler, and carried down by the kitchen offices and across a yard which had once been a garden, to the building which was indifferently known as the laboratory or the dissecting rooms. It was the first time that the lawyer had been received in that part of his friend's quarters, and he eyed the dingy, windowless structure with curiosity, and gazed round with a distasteful sense of strangeness as he crossed the theater, once crowded with eager students, and now lying gaunt and silent, the tables laden with chemical apparatus, the floor strewn with crates and littered with packing straw, and the light falling dimly through the foggy cupola. At the further end, a flight of stairs mounted to a door covered with red baize, and through this, Mr. Utterson was at last received into the doctor's cabinet. It was a large room, fitted round with glass presses, furnished, among other things, with a cheval glass mirror and a business table, and furnished, looking out upon the court by three dusty windows barred with iron. The fire burned in the grate. A lamp was set lighted on the chimney shelf, for even in the houses the fog began to lie thickly. And there, close up to the warmth, sat Dr. Jekyll himself, looking deadly pale. He did not rise to meet his visitor, but held out a cold hand and bade him welcome in a changed voice. "And now," said Mr. Utterson, as soon as Poole had left them, "you have heard the news." The doctor shuddered. "They were crying it in the square," he said. "I heard them in my dining room." "One word," said the lawyer. "Carew was my client, but so are you, and I want to know what I am doing. You have not been mad enough to hide this fellow."
"Utterson, I swear to God," cried the doctor, "I swear to God I will never set eyes on him again. I bind my honor to you that I am done with him in this world. It is all at an end. And indeed, he does not want my help. You do not know him as I do. He is safe. He is quite safe. Mark my words, he will never more be heard of."
The lawyer listened gloomily. He did not like his friend's feverish manner. "You seem pretty sure of him, and for your sake I hope you may be right. If it came to a trial, your name might appear."
"I am quite sure of him," replied Jekyll. "I have grounds for certainty that I cannot share with anyone, but there is one thing on which you may advise me. I have received a letter, and I am at a loss whether I should show it to the police. I should like to leave it in your hands, Utterson. You would judge wisely. I am sure I have so great a trust in you."
"You fear, I suppose, that it might lead to his detection?" asked the lawyer.
"No," said the other. "I cannot say that I care what becomes of Hyde. I am quite done with him, and I was thinking of my own character, which this hateful business has rather exposed."
Utterson ruminated a while he was surprised at his friend's selfishness. He was also relieved by it. "Well, let me see the letter," he said. The letter was written in an odd, upright hand, and signed Edward Hyde, and it signified, briefly enough, that the writer's benefactor, Dr. Jekyll, whom he had long so unworthily repaid for 1,000 generosities, need labor under no alarm for his safety, as he had means of escape on which he placed a sure dependence. The lawyer liked this letter well enough. It put a better color on the intimacy than he had looked for, and he blamed himself for some of his past suspicions.
"Have you the envelope?" he asked. "I burned it," replied Jekyll, "before I thought what I was about, but it bore no postmark. The note was handed in."
"Shall I keep this and sleep upon it?" asked Utterson.
"I wish you to judge for me entirely," was the reply. "I have lost confidence in myself."
"Well, I shall consider," returned the lawyer. "And now one word more. It was Hyde who dictated the terms in your will about that disappearance, wasn't it?" The doctor seemed seized with a qualm of faintness. He shut his mouth tight and nodded. "I knew it. He meant to murder you. You have had a fine escape."
"I have had what is far more to the purpose than that," returned the doctor solemnly. "I have had a lesson. Oh God, Utterson, what a lesson I have had!"
And he covered his face for a moment with his hands. On his way out, the lawyer stopped and had a word or two with Poole. "By the by," he said, "there was a letter handed in today. What was the messenger like?" But Poole was positive nothing had come except by post, and only circulars by that, he added. This news sent off the lawyer with his fears renewed. Plainly the letter had come by the laboratory door. Possibly, indeed, it had been written in the cabinet, and if that were so, it must be differently judged and handled with the more caution. The newsboys, as he went, were crying themselves hoarse along the footways.
"Special edition! Shocking murder of an MP!"
That was the funeral oration of one friend and client. He could not help a certain apprehension lest the good name of another should be sucked down in the eddy of the scandal. It was, at least, a ticklish decision that he had to make. And self-reliant, as he was by habit, he began to cherish a longing for advice. It was not to be had directly, but perhaps, he thought, it might be fished for. Presently, he sat on one side of his own hearth, with Mr. Guest, his head clerk, upon the other. And midway between, at a nicely calculated distance from the fire, a bottle of a particular old wine that had long dwelt unsunned in the foundations of his house. There was no man from whom he kept fewer secrets than Mr. Guest, and he was not always sure that he kept as many as he meant. Guest had often been on business to the doctor's. He knew Poole. He could scarce have failed to hear of Mr. Hyde's familiarity about the house. He might draw conclusions. Was it not as well, then, that he should see a letter which put that mystery to rights? And above all, since Guest, being a great student and critic of handwriting, would consider the step natural and obliging. The clerk, besides, was a man of counsel. He would scarce read so strange a document without dropping a remark, and by that remark Mr. Utterson might shape his future course. "This is a sad business about Sir Danvers," he said.
"Yes, sir, indeed. It has elicited a great deal of public feeling," returned Guest.
"The man, of course, was mad."
"Hmm. I should like to hear your views on that," replied Utterson. "I have a document here in his handwriting. It is between ourselves, for I scarce know what to do about it. It's an ugly business at the best, but there it is, quite in your way. A murderer's autograph."
Guest's eyes brightened, and he sat down at once and studied it with a passion.
"No, sir," he said. "Not mad, but it is an odd hand."
"By all accounts, a very odd writer," added the lawyer. Just then, the servant entered with a note.
"Is that from Dr. Jekyll, sir?" inquired the clerk. "I thought I knew the writing. Anything private, Mr. Utterson?"
"Only an invitation to dinner. Why? Do you want to see it?"
"One moment. I thank you, sir."
And the clerk laid the two sheets of paper alongside and sedulously compared their contents.
"Thank you, sir," he said at last, returning both.
"It's a very interesting autograph." There was a pause, during which Mr. Utterson struggled with himself.
"Why did you compare them, Guest?"
"Well, sir, there's a rather singular resemblance. The two hands are, in many points, identical, only differently sloped."
"Rather quaint," said Utterson.
"It is, as you say, rather quaint," returned Guest.
"I wouldn't speak of this note, Guest."
"No, sir," said the clerk. "I understand."
But no sooner was Mr. Utterson alone that night than he locked the note into his safe, where it reposed from that time forward.
"What," he thought, "Henry Jekyll forged for a murderer?" And his blood ran cold in his veins.
Bring my bones again.
Time ran on. Thousands of pounds were offered in reward, for the death of Sir Danvers was resented as a public injury. But Mr. Hyde had disappeared out of the ken of the police as though he had never existed. Much of his past was unearthed, indeed, and all disreputable. Tales came out of the man's cruelty, at once so callous and violent, of his vile life, of his strange associates, of the hatred that seemed to have surrounded his career, but of his presence, his whereabouts, not a whisper. From the time he had left the house in Soho to the morning of the murder, he was simply blotted out. Gradually, as time drew on, Mr. Utterson began to recover from the hotness of his alarm, and to grow more quiet with himself. The death of Sir Danvers was, to his way of thinking, more than paid for by the disappearance of Mr. Hyde. Now that the evil influence had been withdrawn, a new life began for Dr. Jekyll. He came out of his seclusion, renewed relations with his friends, became once more their familiar guest and entertainer. and whilst he had always been known for charities, he was now no less distinguished for his religion. He was busy. He was much in the open air. He did good. His face seemed to open and brighten, as if with an inward consciousness of service. And for more than 2 months, the doctor was at peace. On the 8th of January, Utterson had dined at the doctor's with a small party. Lanyon had been there, and the face of the host had looked from one to the other as in the old days when the trio were inseparable friends. On the 12th, and again on the 14th, the door was shut against the lawyer. "The doctor was confined to the house," Poole said, "and saw no one." On the 15th he tried again and was again refused, and having now been accustomed for the last 2 months to seeing his friend almost daily, he found this return of solitude to weigh upon his spirits. The 5th night he had in guest the clerk to dine with him, and on the 6th he betook himself to Dr. Lanyon's. There, at least, he was not denied admittance, but when he came in, he was shocked at the change which had taken place in the doctor's appearance. He had his death warrant written legibly upon his face. The rosy man had grown pale, his flesh had fallen away, he was visibly balder and older. Yet it was not so much these tokens of a swift physical decay that arrested the lawyer's notice as a look in the eye and quality of manner that seemed to testify to some deep-seated terror of the mind. It was unlikely that the doctor should fear death, and yet that was what Utterson was tempted to suspect. "Yes," he thought, "he is a doctor. He must know his own state and that his days are counted, and the knowledge is more than he can bear." And yet when Utterson remarked on his ill looks, it was with an air of great firmness that Lanyon declared himself a doomed man. "I have had a great shock," he said, "and I shall not recover. It is a question of weeks. Well, life has been pleasant. I liked it. Yes, sir, I used to like it. I sometimes think if we knew all, we should be more glad to get away." "Jekyll is ill, too," observed Utterson. "Have you seen him?" But Lanyon's face changed. He held up a trembling hand. "I wish to see or hear no more of Dr. Jekyll," he said in a loud, unsteady voice. "I am quite done with that person, and I beg that you will spare me any allusion to one whom I regard as dead." After a considerable pause, Mr. Utterson inquired, "Can't I do anything? We are three very old friends, Lanyon. We shall not live to make others."
"Nothing can be done," returned Lanyon. "Ask him yourself."
"He will not see me," said the lawyer.
"I am not surprised at that. Some day, Utterson, after I am dead, you may perhaps come to learn the right and wrong of this. I cannot tell you. And in the meantime, if you can sit and talk with me of other things, for God's sake, stay and do so. But if you cannot keep clear of this accursed topic, then in God's name, go, for I cannot bear it."
As soon as he got home, Utterson sat down and wrote to Jekyll, complaining of his exclusion from the house and asking the cause of this unhappy break with Lanyon. The next day brought him a long answer. Often confusedly written, sometimes darkly mysterious in drift. The quarrel with Lanyon was incurable. "I do not blame our old friend," Jekyll wrote.
but I share his view that we must never meet. I mean from henceforth to lead a life of extreme seclusion. You must not be surprised, dear Utterson, nor must you doubt my friendship if my door is often shut even to you. You must suffer me to go my own dark way. I have brought on myself a punishment and a danger that I cannot name. If I am the chief of sinners, I am the chief of sufferers also. I could not think that this earth contained a place for sufferings and terrors so unmanning. And you can do but one thing, Utterson, to lighten this destiny, and that is to respect my silence. Utterson was amazed. The dark influence of Hyde had been withdrawn. The doctor had returned to his old tasks and amities. A week ago, the prospect had smiled with every promise of a cheerful and an honored age. And now, in a moment, friendship and peace of mind and the whole tenor of his life were wrecked. So great and unprepared a change pointed to madness, but in view of Lanyon's manner and words, there must lie for it some deeper ground. A week afterwards, Dr. Lanyon took to his bed, and in something less than a fortnight, he was dead. The night after the funeral, at which he had been sadly affected, Utterson locked the door of his business room, and sitting there by the light of a melancholy candle, drew out and set before him an envelope addressed by the hand and sealed with the seal of his dead friend. Private, for the hands of J.G. Utterson alone, and in case of his predecease, to be destroyed unread. So it was emphatically superscribed, and the lawyer dreaded to behold its contents. I have buried one friend today, he thought. What if this should cost me another? And then he condemned the fear as a disloyalty and broke the seal. Within, there was another enclosure, likewise sealed, and marked upon the cover as "Not to be opened till the death or disappearance of Dr. Henry Jekyll." Utterson could not believe his eyes. Yes, it was disappearance. Here again, as in the mad will which he had long ago restored to its author, here again were the idea of a disappearance and the name of Henry Jekyll bracketed. But in the will, that idea had sprung from the sinister suggestion of the man Hyde. It was set here with a purpose all too plain, there in the will. But written by the hand of Lanyon, what could it mean? A great curiosity came to the trustee to disregard the prohibition and dive at once to the bottom of these mysteries. But professional honor and faith to his dead friend were stringent obligations, and the packet slept in the inmost corner of his private safe. It is one thing to mortify curiosity, another to conquer it, and it may be doubted if, from that day forth, Utterson desired the society of his surviving friend with the same eagerness. He thought of him kindly, but his thoughts were disquieted and fearful. He went to call, indeed, but he was perhaps relieved to be denied admittance. Perhaps in his heart he preferred to speak with Poole upon the doorstep, surrounded by the air and sounds of the open city, rather than to be admitted into that house of voluntary bondage, to sit and speak with its inscrutable recluse. Poole had, indeed, no very pleasant news to communicate. The doctor, it appeared, now more than ever, confined himself to the cabinet over the laboratory, where he would sometimes even sleep. He was out of spirits. He had grown very silent. He did not read. It seemed as if he had something on his mind. Utterson became so used to the unvarying character of these reports that he fell off little by little in the frequency of his visits.
It chanced on Sunday, when Mr. Utterson was on his usual walk with Mr. Enfield, that their way lay once again through the by-street, and that when they came in front of the door, both stopped to gaze on it.
"Well," said Enfield, "that story's at an end, at least. We shall never see more of Mr. Hyde."
"I hope not," said Utterson. "Did I ever tell you that I once saw him and shared your feeling of repulsion?"
"It was impossible to do the one without the other," returned Enfield.
"And by the way, what an ass you must have thought me not to know that this was a back way to Dr. Jekyll's. It was partly your own fault that I found it out, even when I did, you know."
"So you found it out, did you?" said Utterson. "Well, if that be so, then we may step into the court and take a look at the windows. Call out to him, perhaps. To tell you the truth, I am uneasy about poor Jekyll, and even outside I feel as if the presence of a friend might do him good."
The court was very cool and a little damp and full of premature twilight, although the sky, high up overhead, was still bright with sunset. The middle one of the three windows was halfway open, and sitting close beside it, taking the air with an infinite sadness of mien, like some disconsolate prisoner, Utterson saw Dr. Jekyll.
"Jekyll," he cried, "I trust you are better."
"I am very low, Utterson," replied the doctor drearily. "Very low. It will not last long, thank God."
"You stay too much indoors," said the lawyer. "You should be out, whipping up the circulation like Mr. Enfield and me. And this is my cousin, Mr. Enfield, Dr. Jekyll. Come now, get your hat and take a quick turn with us."
"You are very good," sighed Jekyll. "I should like very much to, but no, no, it is quite impossible. I dare not. But indeed, Utterson, I am very glad to see you. This is really a great pleasure. I would ask you and Mr. Enfield up, but the place is really not fit."
"Well then," said the lawyer good-naturedly, "the best thing we can do is to stay down here and speak with you from where we are."
"That's what I was about to propose," returned the doctor with a smile, but the words were hardly uttered before the smile was struck out of his face, and succeeded by an expression of such abject terror and despair as froze the very blood of the two gentlemen below. They saw it but for a glimpse, for the window was instantly thrust down. But that glimpse had been sufficient, and they turned and left the court without a word.
In silence, too, they traversed the by-street. It was not until they had come into a neighboring thoroughfare, where even upon a Sunday there were some stirrings of life still, that Mr. Utterson at last turned and looked at his companion. They were both pale. There was an answering horror in their eyes.
"God forgive us," said Mr. Utterson. "God forgive us."
But Mr. Enfield only nodded his head very seriously and walked on once more in silence. Mr. Utterson was sitting by his fireside one evening after dinner when he was surprised to receive a visit from Jekyll's butler.
"Bless me, Poole, what brings you here?" he cried. And then, taking a second look at him, added, "Is the doctor ill?"
"Mr. Utterson," said the man, "there is something wrong."
"Take a seat. Here is a glass of wine for you," said the lawyer. "Now, take your time and tell me plainly what you want."
"You know the doctor's ways, sir, and how he shuts himself up. Well, he's shut himself up again in the cabinet, and I don't like it, sir. I wish I may die if I like it. Mr. Utterson, sir, I'm afraid."
"Now, my good man, be explicit. What are you afraid of?"
"I've been afraid for about a week," returned Poole, doggedly disregarding the question, "and I can bear it no more."
The man's appearance amply bore out his words. His manner was altered for the worse, and except for the moment when he had first announced his terror, had not once looked the lawyer in the face. Even now he sat with the glass of wine untasted on his knee and his eyes directed to a corner of the floor. "I can bear it no more," he repeated.
"Come. I see you have some good reason, Poole. I see that there is something seriously amiss. Try to tell me what it is."
"Sir, I believe there's been foul play."
"Foul play?" cried the lawyer, a good deal frightened, and rather inclined to be irritated in consequence. "What foul play? What does the man mean?"
"I daren't say, sir. But will you come along with me and see for yourself?"
Mr. Utterson's only answer was to rise and get his hat and greatcoat, but he observed with wonder the greatness of the relief that appeared upon the butler's face, and perhaps with no less, that the wine was still untasted when he set it down to follow.
It was a wild, cold, unseasonable night of March, with a pale moon lying on her back as though the wind had tilted her. The wind made talking difficult and flecked the blood into the face. It seemed to have swept the streets unusually bare of passengers besides, for Mr. Utterson thought he had never seen that part of London so deserted.
"Well, sir," said the butler upon arrival at Dr. Jekyll's, "here we are, and God grant that there be nothing wrong."
"Amen, Poole," said the lawyer.
The hall, when they entered it, was brightly lighted up. The fire was built high, and about the hearth the whole of the servants, men and women, stood huddled together like a flock of sheep. At the sight of Mr. Utterson, the housemaid broke into hysterical whimpering, and the cook, crying out, "Bless God, it's Mr. Utterson," ran forward as if to take him in her arms.
What is this? Are you all here?" said the lawyer. "Very irregular, very unseemly. Your master would be far from pleased."
"They're all afraid, sir," said Poole. Blank silence followed, no one protesting. Only the maid lifted up her voice and now wept loudly.
"Hold your tongue," Poole said to her,
and he grabbed a candle, begged Mr. Utterson to follow him, and led the way to the back garden.
"Now, sir," he said, "you come as gently as you can. I want you to hear, and I don't want to be heard, if you understand. And see here, sir, if by any chance he was to ask you in, don't go."
Mr. Utterson's nerves at this unlooked-for termination gave a jerk that nearly threw him from his balance. He recollected his courage and followed the butler into the laboratory building and through the surgical theater, with its lumber of crates and bottles, to the foot of the stair. Here, Poole motioned him to stand on one side and listen, while he himself, setting down the candle and making a great and obvious call on his resolution, mounted the steps and knocked with a somewhat uncertain hand on the red baize of the cabinet door.
"Mr. Utterson, sir, asking to see you," he called.
And even as he did so, once more violently signed to the lawyer to give ear. A voice answered from within,
"Tell him I cannot see anyone."
"Thank you, sir,"
said Poole, with a note of something like triumph in his voice. Taking up his candle, he led Mr. Utterson back across the yard into the great kitchen, where the fire was out and the beetles were leaping on the floor.
"Sir," he said, looking Mr. Utterson in the eye, "was that my master's voice?"
"It seems much changed," replied the lawyer, very pale, but giving look for look.
"Changed? Well, yes, I think so," said the butler. Have I been 20 years in this man's house to be deceived about his voice? No, sir. Master's made away with. He was made away with 8 days ago, when we heard him cry out upon the name of God. And who's in there instead of him, and why it stays there is a thing that cries to heaven, Mr. Utterson.
This is a very strange tale, Poole. This is a rather wild tale, my man, said Utterson, biting his finger. Suppose it were as you suppose, supposing Dr. Jekyll to have been, well, murdered. What could induce the murderer to stay? That won't hold water. It doesn't commend itself to reason.
Well, Mr. Utterson, you are a hard man to satisfy, but I'll do it yet, said Poole.
All this last week, you must know, him or it or whatever it is that lives in that cabinet has been crying night and day for some sort of medicine and cannot get it to his mind. It was sometimes his way, the master's, that is, to write his orders on a sheet of paper and throw it on the stair. We've had nothing else this week back, nothing but papers and a closed door and the very meals left there to be smuggled in when nobody is looking. Well, sir, every day, aye, twice and thrice in the same day, there have been orders and complaints, and I have been sent flying to all the wholesale chemists in town. Every time I brought the stuff back, there would be another paper telling me to return it, because it was not pure. Another order to a different firm. This drug is wanted bitter bad, sir. Whatever for.
Have you any of these papers? Asked Mr. Utterson.
Poole felt in his pocket and handed out a crumpled note, which the lawyer, bending nearer to the candle, carefully examined. Its contents run thus. Dr. Jekyll presents his compliments to Messrs. Maw. He assures them that their last sample is impure and quite useless for his present purpose. Some years ago, Dr. J. purchased a somewhat large quantity from Messrs. M. He now begs them to search with the utmost sedulous care, and should any of the same quality be left, to forward it to him at once. Expense is no consideration. The importance of this to Dr. J. can hardly be exaggerated. So far, the letter had run composedly enough, but here, with a sudden splutter of the pen, the writer's emotion had broken loose. For God's sake, he added, find me some of the old.
"This is a strange note," said Mr. Utterson, and then sharply, "How do you come to have it open?"
"The man at Maw's was main angry, sir, and he threw it back to me like so much dirt."
"This is unquestionably the doctor's hand, do you know?"
"I thought it looked like it," said the servant, rather sulkily, and then with another voice. "But what matters hand of right?" he said. "I've seen him."
"Seen him?" repeated Utterson. "Well, go on."
"That's it," said Poole. "It was this way. I came suddenly into the theater from the garden. It seems he had slipped out to look for his drug or whatever it is, for the cabinet door was open, and there he was at the far end of the room digging among the crates. He looked up when I came in and gave a kind of cry and whipped upstairs into the cabinet. It was but for 1 minute that I saw him, but the hair stood upon my head like quills. Sir, if that was my master, why had he a mask upon his face? If that was my master, why did he cry out like a rat and run from me? I have served him long enough. And then..."
The man paused and passed his hand over his face. "These are all very strange circumstances," said Utterson. "But I think I begin to see daylight.
Your master, Poole, is plainly seized with one of those maladies that both torture and deform the sufferer. Hence, for aught I know, the alteration of his voice. Hence the mask and his avoidance of his friends. Hence his eagerness to find this drug by means of which the poor soul retains some hope of ultimate recovery. God grant that he be not deceived. There is my explanation. It is sad enough, Poole, aye, and appalling to consider. But it is plain and natural, and hangs together well, and delivers us from all exorbitant alarms.
Sir, said the butler, turning to a sort of mottled pallor, that thing was not my master, and there's the truth. My master, here he looked round him and began to whisper, is a tall, fine build of a man, and this was more of a dwarf.
Utterson attempted to protest.
Oh, sir, cried Poole, do you think I do not know my master after 20 years? Do you think I do not know where his head comes to, in the cabinet door, where I saw him every morning of my life? No, sir, that thing in the mask was never Dr. Jekyll. God knows what it is, but it was never Dr. Jekyll. And it is the belief of my heart that there was murder done.
Poole, replied the lawyer, if you say that, it will become my duty to make certain. Much as I desire to spare your master's feelings, much as I am puzzled about this note which seems to prove him to be still alive, I shall consider it my duty to break in that door.
Ha, ah, Mr. Utterson, that's talking, cried the butler.
And now comes the second question. Who is going to do it?
Why, you and me, sir.
Well, that is very well said. And whatever comes of it, I shall make it my business to see you are not the loser.
There was an axe in the theater, continued Poole. You might take it, the kitchen poker for yourself, to protect yourself, sir.
The lawyer took that rude but weighty instrument into his hand and balanced it. Do you know, Poole, he said, looking up, that you and I are about to place ourselves in a position of some peril?
You may say so indeed, sir.
It is well, then, that we should be frank. We both think more than we have said. Let us make a clean breast. This masked figure that you saw, did you recognize it?
Well, sir, it went so quick, and the creature was so doubled up that I could hardly swear to that, but if you mean, was it Mr. Hyde, why, yes, I think it was. You see, it was much the same bigness, and it had the same quick, light way with it. And then who else could have got in by the laboratory door? You have not forgot, sir, that at the time of the murder he had still the key with him. But that's not all. I don't know, Mr. Utterson, if ever you met this Mr. Hyde?
Yes, I once spoke with him.
And then you must know, as well as the rest of us, that there was something queer about that gentleman, something that gave a man a turn. I don't know rightly how to say it beyond this, that you felt it in your marrow, kind of cold and thin.
I own I felt something of what you describe, said Utterson.
Quite so, sir, returned Poole.
Well, when that masked thing, like a monkey, jumped from among the chemicals, whipped into the cabinet, it went down my spine like ice. Oh, I know it's not evidence, Mr. Utterson. I'm book-learned enough for that. But a man has his feelings, and I give you my Bible word, it was Hyde.
Aye, said the lawyer. My fears incline to the same point. Evil, I fear, founded. Evil was sure to come of that connection. Aye, truly, I believe you. I believe poor Henry is killed, and I believe his murderer, for what purpose God alone can tell, is still lurking in his victim's room. Well, let our name be vengeance. Call Bradshaw.
The footman came at the summons, very white and nervous. Pull yourself together, Bradshaw. This suspense, I know, is telling upon all of you, but it is now our intention to make an end of it. Poole here and I are going to force our way into the cabinet. If all is well, my shoulders are broad enough to bear the blame. Meanwhile, lest anything should really be amiss or any malefactor seek to escape by the back, you and the boy must go round the corner with a pair of good sticks, take your position at the laboratory door.
We give you 10 minutes to get to your stations. As Bradshaw left, the lawyer looked at his watch. "And now, Poole, let us get to ours," he said, and taking the poker under his arm, he led the way into the yard. The clouds had banked over the moon, and it was now quite dark. The wind, which had only broken puffs and drafts in that deep well of the building, tossed the light of the candle to and fro about their steps until they came into the shelter of the theater. London hummed softly around them, solemnly, but nearer at hand the stillness was only broken by the sound of a footfall moving to and fro along the cabinet floor.
"So it will walk all day, sir," whispered Poole. "Aye, in the better part of the night. Only when a new sample comes from the chemist there's a bit of a break. Ah, it's an ill conscience that such an enemy to rest. Sir, there's blood foully shed in every step of it. But hark again, a little closer. Put your heart in your ears, Mr. Utterson, and tell me, is that the doctor's foot?"
The steps fell lightly and oddly with a certain swing, for all they went so slowly. It was different indeed from the heavy, creaking tread of Henry Jekyll. Utterson sighed. "Is there never anything else?" he asked. Poole nodded.
Once I heard it weeping."
"Weeping? How that?" said the lawyer, conscious of a sudden chill of horror.
"Weeping like a woman or a lost soul," said the butler. "I came away with that upon my heart, that I could have wept too."
But now the 10 minutes drew to an end. Poole disinterred the axe from under a stack of packing straw. The candle was set upon the nearest table to light them to the attack, and they drew nearer with bated breath to where that patient foot was still going up and down in the quiet of the night.
"Jekyll," cried Utterson with a loud voice, "I demand to see you."
He paused a moment, but there came no reply.
"I give you fair warning, our suspicions are aroused, and I must and shall see you. If not by fair means, then by foul. If not of your consent, then by brute force."
"Utterson," said the voice, "for God's sake, have mercy."
"That is not Jekyll's voice." "It's Hyde's," cried Utterson. "Down with the door, Poole."
Poole swung the axe over his shoulder. The blow shook the building, and the red baize door leaped against the lock and hinges. A dismal screech as of a mere animal terror rang from the cabinet. Up went the axe again, and again the panels crashed and the frame bounded. 4 times the blow fell, but the wood was tough and the fittings were excellent workmanship. It was not until the 5th that the lock finally burst in sunder, and the wreck of the door fell inwards on the carpet. The besiegers, appalled by their own riot and the stillness that had succeeded, stood back a little and peered in. There lay the cabinet before their eyes in the quiet lamplight, a good fire glowing and chattering on the hearth, the kettle singing its thin strain, papers neatly set forth on the table. Right in the midst there lay the body of a man sorely contorted and still twitching. They drew near on tiptoe, turned it on its back, and beheld the face of Edward Hyde. He was dressed in clothes too large for him, clothes of the doctor's bigness. The cords of his face still moved with a semblance of life, but life was quite gone. By the crushed vial in the hand and the strong smell of kernels that hung upon the air, Utterson knew that he was looking on the body of a self-destroyer. "We have come too late, whether to save or punish. Hyde is gone to his account, and it only remains for us to find the body of your master." So began the search of corridor and closet and cellar throughout the doctor's home. All these they thoroughly examined. Each closet needed but a glance, for all were empty, and all, by the dust that fell from their doors, had stood long unopened. The cellar, indeed, was filled with crazy lumber, but even as they opened the door they were advertised of the uselessness of further search by the fall of a perfect mat of cobweb which had for years sealed up the entrance. Nowhere was there any trace of Henry Jekyll, dead or alive. Poole stamped on the flags of the corridor.
"He must be buried here," he said, hearkening to the sound.
"Or he may have fled," said Utterson, and he turned to examine the door in the by-street.
It was locked, and lying nearby on the flagstones, they found a key, already stained with rust. "This does not look like use," observed the lawyer.
"Use?" echoed Poole. "Do you not see, sir? It is broken, much as if a man had stamped upon it."
"Hmm. And the fractures, too, are rusty." The two men looked at each other with a scare.
"This is beyond me, Poole," said the lawyer.
"Let us go back to the cabinet." They mounted the stair in silence, and still, with an occasional awestruck glance at the dead body, proceeded more thoroughly to examine the contents of the cabinet. At one table there were traces of chemical work, various measured heaps of some white salt being laid on glass saucers as though for an experiment in which the unhappy man had been prevented.
"That is the same drug that I was always bringing him," said Poole, and even as he spoke the kettle with a startling noise boiled over.
This brought them to the fireside, where the easy chair was drawn cozily up and the tea thing stood ready to the sitter's elbow, the very sugar in the cup. There were several books on a shelf. One lay beside the tea things open, and Utterson was amazed to find a copy of a pious work for which Jekyll had several times expressed a great esteem, annotated in his own hand with startling blasphemies. Next, in the corner, in the course of their review of the chamber, the searchers came to the mirror, into whose depths they looked with involuntary horror. But it was so turned as to show them nothing but the rosy glow playing on the roof, the fire sparkling in 100 repetitions along the glazed front of the presses, and their own pale and fearful countenances stooping to look in.
"This glass has seen some strange things, sir."
"And surely none stranger than itself," said the lawyer. "For what did Jekyll... what could Jekyll want with it?"
"You may say that, Poole."
Next, they turned to the business table. On the desk among the neat array of papers, a large envelope was uppermost and bore in the doctor's hand the name of Mr. Utterson. The lawyer unsealed it, and several enclosures fell to the floor. The first was a will, drawn in the same eccentric terms as the one which he had returned 6 months before, to serve as a testament in case of death and as a deed of gift in case of disappearance. But in place of the name of Edward Hyde, the lawyer, with undescribable amazement, read the name of Gabriel John Utterson. He looked at Poole, then back at the papers, and last of all at the dead malefactor stretched upon the carpet. "My head goes round. He has been all these days in possession. He had no cause to like me. He must have raged to see himself displaced, and he has not destroyed this document." He caught the next paper. It was a brief note in the doctor's hand and dated at the top.
"Poole," the doctor cried, "he was alive and here this very day. He cannot have been disposed of in so short a space. He must be still alive. He must have fled. And then why fled and how?
In that case, can we venture to declare this suicide? Oh, we must be careful. I foresee that we may yet involve your master in some dire catastrophe."
"Why don't you read it, sir?" asked Poole.
"Because I fear," replied the lawyer solemnly. "God grant I have no cause for it." And with that, he brought the paper to his eye and read. "My dear Utterson, when this shall fall into your hands, I shall have disappeared, under what circumstances I have not the penetration to foresee. But my instincts and all the circumstances of my nameless situation tell me that the end is sure and must be early. Go, then, and first read the narrative which Lanyon warned me he was to put in your hands. If you care to hear more, turn to the confession of your unworthy and unhappy friend, Henry Jekyll." "There was a third enclosure?" asked Utterson.
"Here, sir,"
said Poole, and gave into his hands a considerable packet sealed in several places. The lawyer put it in his pocket. "I would say nothing of this paper. If your master has fled or is dead, we may at least save his good name. It is now 10. I must go home and read these documents in quiet. But I shall be back before midnight, when we shall send for the police." They went out, locking the door of the theater behind them, and Utterson, once more leaving the servants gathered about the fire in the hall, trudged back to his office to read the two narratives in which this mystery was now to be explained. But for that, we must wait one more week. The time is 10 p.m. You listen to KVMR FM, Nevada City. My name is T.E. Wolf. This has been A Word in Edgewise. Up next, Randy McKean and The Outpost.